President Bush in 2005 credited the Patriot Act for stopping the Columbus trucker Ayman Faris and his cohorts from carrying out acts of terrorism, including a plot to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge.
The case against him was so strong that Faris chose to cooperate, and he spent the next several weeks telling authorities about his Al-Qaeda association. Faris pled guilty to charges against him. And today, instead of planning terror attacks against the American people, Ayman Faris is sitting in an American prison.
Joining us today to delve deeper into the story is Associated Press legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins. Andrew has a new book coming out, Hatred at Home, Al-Qaeda on Trial in the American Midwest, which looks at how three homegrown terrorists' coffee shop conversation triggered a federal investigation that would become one of the most far-reaching probes into terrorism since the 9/11 attacks. The book will be available in August. Andrew is with us now. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What, you know, anyone who's been around Columbus for the last 10 or so years remembers this case and how it eventually involved three people. What spurred your interest in it? What triggered the book?
This is a very interesting case taken by itself. You have three individuals here in mild-mannered Columbus who were accused of, in various degrees, connections with Al-Qaeda, plotting to undertake some pretty heinous crimes. Ayman Faris was alleged to have been working at directly at the behest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, of course, is the architect of the 9/11 attacks. But they also represent, I think, they're a good illustration of the government's challenge dealing with domestic terrorists after 9/11 in general. They illustrate what the government had to do in terms of finding these plots that were out there and obviously stopping them before anything happened. And they also get to this whole question of, is there overreaching? Is there a point where angry words uttered by someone who may have connections with unsavory characters, you know, at what point does that rise to a crime? And I think one of the things I point out in the book is that the FBI and federal prosecutors, they really had no choice. There may have been some overstepping along the way, both in these cases and other cases, but you have to look at the environment we've been in. What choice did they have when they were investigating these cases?
My guest is Andrew Welsh Huggins. He has a new book coming out, Hatred at Home, Al-Qaeda on Trial in the American Midwest. It looks at how Christopher Paul, who grew up in Worthington, and two others were treated and how they're convicted of terrorism in the United States. If you have a question or comment for Andrew, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about Ayman Faris for starters. He was a truck driver. He lived in Columbus. Tell us what we know about him and what you learned about him in preparing the book.
That's right. Ayman Faris grew up, he was born in Kashmir, which is that disputed territory between India and Pakistan. And I always felt that was sort of appropriate because that is he was born basically in a country torn between two countries, and he ended up being a person, I think, torn between two sides of himself. He grew up there. Grew up in a broken home. His parents split up. When he was in his late teens, a good friend of his who turned out ultimately to be high up in Al-Qaeda, they went to Afghanistan together. So he was part of that whole Mujahideen movement going to Afghanistan. later on in his late 20s or early 30s, he emigrated to the United States. And, you know, there's two versions of this. One is that he simply was coming here to make a better life for himself. There were issues that members of his family may have been in trouble politically at home, and he just wanted to get away from all that and came to the United States. You know, the other suspicion is that he came here fully intent to sort of blend in and carry out these plots. Now, he came to Columbus in 94 worked at a gas station on Hudson Street and ended up marrying a Columbus woman, Geneva Bowling, and they were married for 5 or 6 years. He, several members of the mosque that he attended, which is a mosque actually pretty close to the Ohio State campus, a number of people there were getting into long-distance driving. People just saw it as a pretty good way to make money pretty quickly. So he got his trucking license in South Carolina, and he became a long-distance truck driver. right after 9/11, he was actually interviewed along with many Muslims around the country, not because there was any suspicion he had anything to do with the attacks, but flags went up about him. He was Pakistani. He had a driver's license. He had a hazmat license as part of that. And, you know, when you connect those dots and you start thinking about it, that was someone the FBI wanted to talk to. So they talked to him. They talked to his by-then ex-wife, just as they were chasing all leads.
This was just routine at that point.
That was routine. He was not on their radar for any plot. However, unbeknownst to the FBI at that point, he had actually, previous to 9/11, had been back in Pakistan, had gone with this friend I mentioned into Afghanistan. At one point, he had met Osama bin Laden at a camp where his friend had taken him, and he remarked somewhat famously to his friend when he realized who this was and what was happening, he said, you know, great, that's 400 years right there, referring to some kind of prison sentence that he might get if anybody ever found out what had happened. he was alleged to have purchased a couple thousand sleeping bags with his friend for use in Afghanistan by Al-Qaeda, and returned to the United States, went back to Pakistan, eventually was alleged to have been in touch directly with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Sometimes he's referred to as KSM, the architect of the 9/11 attacks. And he asked him to research ultralight gliders on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, the timeline and the characters here sometimes are a little difficult to follow. But Ferris was also in touch with a man named Majid Khan, who was a Pakistani related to this friend of his who had actually emigrated to Baltimore with his family. And Majid Khan had direct connections with KSM. And at one point, KSM was talking to this Khan about a plot to blow up gas stations in the United States, to poison drinking water. And Ferris would send messages through Khan back to Pakistan. The ultimate thing that we care about is that at a certain point, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed asked Ferris to look at the possibility of taking down the Brooklyn Bridge. What would that take? And what they looked at was this idea of gas cutters, basically big, giant propane torches that somehow would sever the cables on the Brooklyn Bridge. Ferris looked into it, talked to somebody he knew about it, explored the idea, was alleged to have traveled to New York City, checked it out, scoped it out. He ultimately decided the plan wouldn't work. There was a lot of security, obviously, around the Brooklyn Bridge by this time. This is post 9/11 by this time. And he sent a message back that went something like, he said, "The weather is too hot." That was the message that he sent back to Pakistan, meaning this isn't going to work.
As far as a lot of this activity, particularly the Brooklyn Bridge, had that occurred before the FBI interviewed him on that routine basis, or was this all sort of happening simultaneously?
This would have been after.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he'd already had been interviewed. He already knew he was on somebody's radar screen somewhere.
That's right. He had been interviewed. It was part of the FBI probably interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of people after 9/11, like Ayman Ferris, people who just piqued their interest. They didn't suspect them of any crime. But you're right. He had gone ahead after that.
So what was the trigger that that got the FBI to turn back around and look at him? What happened? How did he get their attention?
There were two developments almost simultaneous. The FBI was looking at this Majid Khan that I mentioned, who mm-hmm. was actually a fairly young person, in late teens, lived in Baltimore, spoke English very well, sounded quote-unquote like an American. Mm-hmm. But the FBI had been listening in on Majid Khan's phone calls, and they picked up communications with Faris. Khan eventually returned to Pakistan, and in March 1st of 2003, the Pakistani authorities, along with the U.S., arrested Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Rawalpindi. And Mohammed, of course, people will remember, he is the one who was waterboarded dozens and dozens of times to get information, and some of the information that came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed got into this whole Brooklyn Bridge plot, and by this time, Faris's, you know, the bells were going off about Faris.
His family, did they know about what he was doing, his wife?
His wife, I think, by February or March of 2003, she's his ex-wife by this time, although they had stayed in touch and their divorce was fairly amicable. I think she knew something was happening. I don't think she knew anything about the plot. I think she did know that the FBI, or at least the government, was definitely interested in talking to him about something. I don't think she knew any details of what had happened.
There's been a lot of sensitivity about what the mosques, what American mosques have known about their members, you know, over time, over the past 10 years, and how whether or not they're participating and helping flush out people like Ayman Faris. Did you talk to anybody from the mosque that he went to and talk to them about what they knew about him, if they knew what he was up to?
Sure. The mosque, the Omar Mosque, is right close to campus. It's actually one of the earliest mosques built in Columbus. Believe it or not, it was a Jehovah's Witness hall before it was a mosque. It has has a reputation perhaps for being a more conservative mosque. I don't think anyone in the mosque was aware of what Faris was up to. Faris, of the three people we're talking about, Faris was probably the least devout in a way. His wife would often refer to him as a pick-and-choose Muslim. There were things he insisted on in terms of being a Muslim, but he loved American fast food. He loved American movies. He played video games constantly with his stepson, often just hung around in jeans and a shirt. It did not wear the typical Muslim dress as much as his friends. You know, he would go to the mosque because it was a place where he knew people and he would hang out, but I don't think he went there because he was particularly religious or devout.
My guest is Andrew Welsh Huggins. We're talking about his new book. It's due out in August. It's called Hatred at Home, Al-Qaeda on Trial in the American Midwest. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Neil Conan. When news breaks, you have your own questions that go beyond who, what, where, and when. Talk of the Nation connects to the people who make the news and gives you an opportunity to get answers to your questions. Join us for Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Tangled Webs, James B. Stewart, Tuesday evening, May 3rd at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
Become an 89.7 NPR News sustaining member. No more checks to write, and your member card will never expire. For as little as $5 per month, you'll be supporting great programs. Visit wosu.org/sustainer.
We're talking about the case of Ayman Faris and his cohorts. Ayman is the Columbus truck driver accused of plotting to blow up a mall on the day after Thanksgiving in 2003. My guest is AP legal affairs reporter Andrew Welsh Huggins. He's written a new book on the case. It's due out in August. Let's hear some more about his one of his accomplices.
Paul is accused of conspiring to bomb European resorts where Americans frequent and U.S. embassies and military bases overseas. He is also accused of attending terrorist training camps and at one point joining Al-Qaeda.
That's Mandy Trimble of WOSU. She's talking about the Worthington man accused of helping the terrorist group, who he agreed to plead guilty in June 2009. It's Christopher Paul. He pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction. Tell us about Christopher Paul. He's the All-American kid.
That's right. Very interesting guy. Grew up here in Worthington. Graduated from what was then just Worthington High School. This was in 83. There's two high schools now, but it was Worthington High School, now Thomas Worthington. was quite a good gymnast. A lot of people remember him. And at the time, he was actually born and went by, his name was Paul Laws at the time. So he's a member of the Laws family. And he was quite a good gymnast, and the team at that time was quite good, and they competed at the state championships. After he graduated from Worthington, he went to Ohio State for a while, and at that point converted to Islam, began dressing in traditional Islamic garb. His family says they sort of took it in stride because he was pretty much the same old Paul, nice, sweet guy. Everybody remembers him as friendly, cooperative, just nice guy. But at some point, something switched. It's clear that he felt passionately about what was going on in Afghanistan at the time. Listeners will remember this is the mid to late 80s by now. The Soviet occupation of Afghanistan was ongoing. There were a lot of terrible atrocities that the Soviets had promulgated on Afghani citizens. This was a huge concern. There was an entire Mujahideen movement that Paul Laws became part of. He changed his name in Franklin County Court in 1989. He became Abdulmalik Kenyatta, and that's how people who remember him in the Muslim community, that's how they know of him. He traveled abroad for several years. He was in Afghanistan. He was in the Balkans in the early 90s as part of as Yugoslavia broke up. He was there. There was a whole group of what they call the Afghan Arabs, who sort of came of age as Mujahideen in Afghanistan, but then were sort of stateless at that point. Many of them moved on to the Balkans as part of that conflict, and Abdulmalik Kenyatta went with them, and he was over there. Came back to Columbus in the mid to late 90s, married a British woman of Pakistani origin. They moved here. He settled in an apartment very near the mosque on Riverview, one-room apartment. They lived very frugally. But he also kept up some fairly unusual connections. He had made connections with terrorism cells in Germany and traveled to Germany, assisted them allegedly in plots that they were undertaking to carry out attacks over there. And these are some pretty bad guys. A couple of the people that he was associating with knew or had connections with the 9/11 hijackers. People will remember that much of 9/11 was actually plotted in Germany, in Hamburg. Christopher Paul, or Paul Laws, he had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, but he was associating with people who were in pretty deep. He came back to the United States, back to Columbus, worked at a local factory. I think it was pretty quiet for him after that, but he was friends with Ayman Faris and with Nuruddin Abdi, and the FBI became aware of him actually through Faris and Abdi sort of simultaneously during different investigations.
Nuruddin Abdi's defense attorney Mahir Sharif told WOSU's Tom Borgerding that his client pleaded guilty to a single charge of conspiring to provide material support to terrorists to avoid a jury's reaction given the current mood of the country. He was accused with Ayman Faris and Christopher Paul of plotting to blow up a mall on the day after Thanksgiving in 2003.
They talked, and yeah, he went to get training. We didn't deny that. He went to Somalia. He tried to go to Kosovo. He tried to go to Bosnia. There's some facts that we can't deny. They talked. There was a rangefinder, obviously. So in this climate, an American jury, we felt, could potentially find him guilty because of all this negative stuff that's coming in. And if they found him guilty, he was looking at spending the rest of his life in custody.
So tell us about Nuruddin Habdi and then also how they all three of them met.
Yeah, and just to correct one thing, because it is crucial to the whole story, Ferris and Paul were never accused, at least in court papers, of having anything to do with this shopping mall plot.
Okay.
And what makes this so interesting is they had known each other for several years, essentially from attending the same mosque. And in August of 2002, they went for coffee at the Caribou Cafe up on Lane Avenue. I'm sure a lot of people know right where this is. And this was, of course, 10 months into the U.S. action in Afghanistan following 9/11. There had been many, many reports about civilian casualties in that operation. These three people were very angry about this. They felt like these casualties were unjust. They also felt like they weren't resonating with the American people. This was an angry conversation. During this conversation, they started talking about things they could do. And Ferris he threw out some idea about the Hoover Dam, and somebody had another idea. And Abdi sort of blurted out, "Well, you know what we should do? I should just take an AK-47 and shoot up a shopping mall." Now, that comment, obviously, when the FBI became aware of that comment the following spring when they were interviewing Ayman Ferris, and at that point they began an investigation into Nuruddin Abdi, and they became convinced that Abdi was going to carry out this plan on the day after Thanksgiving in 2003. So he was taken into custody that morning, actually as he was on his way to morning prayers at his mosque. And then he was in custody for several months before he was ever charged. He was initially actually arrested for immigration violations, and then he was charged criminally. Now, his attorney, I think, made the point at the time, and Abdi never intended to plead guilty. He fought vigorously, and this went through – I have – boxes of court papers regarding this. But ultimately, he did change his mind. He felt like he would be convicted, that no American jury would acquit him. That said, the government's case against Abdi was pretty weak, based on the fact that he was being offered in May of 2004. He was offered as little as 5 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned it down. He said, I'm not going to testify against anybody. See, they wanted him to testify against Christopher Paul, and he said, I'm not going to do it. Ultimately, he received a 10-year prison sentence. By that time, he'd already been in jail for 4.5 years. And the other interesting thing about his case is he's scheduled for deportation next year to Somalia. But the problem is Somalia does not have a functioning government. So there's a lot of questions about what's going to happen to Nuruddin Abdi. Our government does not have a policy, as far as I understand, of deporting people to essentially stateless regions.
Well, for that matter, Christopher Paul, eventually he was sentenced to 20 years.
That's right.
What it does make you wonder what does happen to these folks after they've been imprisoned for many years for doing something that they probably felt pretty righteous about at the time. What happens? What kind of incubator have we created, and what's happening when they get out? Because 20 years isn't that long.
No, and, you know, it's – there's no way to predict. Christopher Paul, I think, felt passionately that he was standing up for his religion, and at people, Muslims at his mosque and elsewhere, while not defending him at all, mm-hmm. pointed out that in the 1980s, the United States essentially applauded people for going to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets and to side with the residents of Afghanistan. And then after 9/11, suddenly they were criminals for doing what they saw as the same sorts of activities. It's hard to know what Christopher Paul will do when he comes back. He still has a good, I think, 15 years left. I think he, in some ways, was by far the most radicalized. The people he was associating with mm-hmm. were very dangerous criminals. That said, it's hard to know or predict if he's going to come back as a terrorist or just somebody who wants to get on with his life.
My guest is Andrew Welsh Huggins. He is the author of No Winners Here Tonight, Race, Politics, and Geography in One of the Country's Busiest Death Penalty States. Talk to him about that. His new book, Hatred at Home, Al-Qaeda on Trial in the American Midwest, comes out in August. Mark from South Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. And for Andrew, a question and a little parallel one for Ann that she might be more familiar with. With the Christopher Paul, whom you just mentioned, I'm someone who had distributed a lot of campaign material and issue materials and things in that west area of campus around where he lived, near the mosque, near Channel 4 and all that. And I was somewhat familiar with the area, and it was real obvious to me, and I think most anyone in that neighborhood, that there was something seriously wrong with Christopher Paul. He didn't seem personally threatening, but he was sort of had a glazed look on him. He was sort of zealous religious fundamentalist, sort of look through you and not at you, asking you, are you a good Muslim? Have you converted? Blah, blah, so on. So it was sort of obvious, like, the guy wasn't right. And so often with the federal investigations and the FBI, they put in hundreds of thousands of hours and millions of dollars to find out what was obvious to pretty much anyone in the neighborhood or neighbors. And a similar thing that Ann would be more familiar with, National Century Financial Enterprises, a big raid on them on Election Day in November 2002. There had been national activists protesting them for 2 years for their fraudulent activities. But they, when the feds came in and raided them, they pretended like, we just discovered the secret fact and no one knew, even though it was just common knowledge. So just your thoughts on that, and I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Well, I'm just going to make a stab at this here and tell me what you think, Andrew, that they have to make a case against these folks. They can't, it just can't be suppositions and personality traits.
Well, I think that's right, and I think if the FBI had a threshold of going after every religious person who seemed a bit passionate about their faith, regardless of what faith we're talking about, mm-hmm. I think the FBI would be pretty busy. I think it was well known that Christopher Paul felt very strongly about his religion. He had converted to it. He was passionate about it. He married a Muslim. He lived within walking distance of his mosque. Islam was very, very important to Christopher Paul. But that's not the same as having the facts that can lead to what prosecutors call probable cause for indicting someone. Keep in mind, Nourdin Abdi was arrested in 2003. He was indicted in 2004. Christopher Paul was not indicted for another 3 years. It took the FBI and prosecutors a long time to figure out what they had here, and they wanted to take their time. Obviously, they wanted to build their case. They haven't told me or anybody else a whole lot about why it took so long, but they've made it clear that they wanted all their ducks in the row before they made this arrest. also, for what it's worth, Christopher Paul did not fight his indictment in basically any way. There's probably a slim manila folder worth of legal documents from his case. About the most radical thing he did was he asked for a six-month delay so documents could be translated, and he pled guilty. I don't think he felt in any way he was not interested in fighting his case or taking it to trial. I don't know his true motives for pleading guilty, but it's clear this was not something he was going to fight.
Were you allowed to talk to any of them?
The only communication, first of all, Iman Ferris is in the federal supermax in Florence, Colorado, and some of his fellow residents include Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, mm-hmm. Richard Reed, the guy who tried to take the plane down with the bomb in his shoe. And my attempts to talk to Ferris have been routinely turned down. I traded some brief it's a type of email that the prison system uses. I've traded some very brief messages with Nourdin Abdi, but he has not really been interested in talking, and Christopher Paul has essentially never responded to my requests. I've certainly talked to family members of all three, and in the case of Ferris, he filed several court documents that were essentially his statements. Same with Abdi, actually. So certainly that's not as good as talking to them, but we have somewhat of a picture of what they think and what they felt.
The government lawyers, they spoke of catastrophes averted. Defense attorneys countered that none of the three had really done anything but talk. And I wondered if you know how the three of them sort of got together. Was it just at the mosque? Was it just, did they have mutual friends? How did they wind up in that coffee shop?
I think the way you put it is exactly right. They knew each other from the mosque, and they became friends. Now, Ayman Ferris and Christopher Paul were actually quite good friends. It was quite common for Paul to come over to Ferris's house. At the time, they lived in the Linden area, and very common for him to come over. And this has always struck me as interesting because, again, Ferris was this kind of fun-loving, sort of free-spirited guy, didn't wear a lot of traditional Muslim clothes. He had very long, wavy hair. If you've ever seen a picture of him, mm-hmm. does not sort of look like the traditional religious Muslim, whereas Paul was very traditional. They were good friends. And then Abdi sort of came into their circle of acquaintances. Paul socialized just a little bit with Abdi. They had dinner at Abdi's mother's house one night. So they were essentially friends who got to know each other. And I think what you just said is very true. Catastrophes were averted, but on the other hand, these guys never did anything. But they associated, especially in Ferris and Paul's case, they associated with people who did very bad things. You may not like or appreciate the fact that attending a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan where bin Laden shows up or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but that's pretty much enough for you right there, post 9/11. And, of course, keep in mind, Ferris acknowledged doing this research on the bridge, doing these tasks, selling the sleeping bags or buying the sleeping bags. Mm-hmm. You know, Abdi was trading messages with Ferris, emails about, you know, terror websites and different possible things he could do. He provided credit card numbers from his cell phone shop to Paul. I guess we'll have to assume he had an idea what Paul might use them for. We don't know if Paul actually used them. To summarize, Ferris and Paul were associating with some pretty bad people. Abdi was associating with Ferris and Paul. And in this environment, that was enough for the indictment and ultimately, apparently, enough for him to plead guilty.
Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne. It was great to be here.
Andrew Welsh Huggins, he has a new book coming out. It's called Hatred at Home, Al-Qaeda on Trial in the American Midwest. It's the story behind the Ayman Ferris, Nuruddin Abdi, and Christopher Paul, all Columbus men who were associated with terrorism. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
The next Fresh Air, we talk with Jani Scott, author of the new book about Barack Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, called A Singular Woman.
She was a thoroughly unconventional person who dared to do things that many of us don't even try to do now.
Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
While in high school, Natalia Ledford began a documentary about some of her classmates, survivors of one of the bloodiest civil wars in African history. Tuesday night watches her film explores the experiences of several Sudanese men and women who fled civil war in their home country and resettled in Lincoln, Nebraska. Ledford's classmates' stories of struggle and resilience spurred her to continue researching the civil conflict ravaging the country. Watch Paths of the Displaced Tuesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Westfield Insurance, exclusive sponsor of In the Know. This season's semifinal matches re-air Fridays at 8 p.m. on WOSU+. Westfield Insurance, sharing knowledge, building trust.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
This year marks the 50th anniversary tour of the Scioto River Valley. How did a two-day ride between two people, a father and son, turn into a nationally known trek that attracts thousands of riders every year? We've invited longtime tour director Charlie Pace to tell us. Welcome to the show, Charlie.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Greg Seipel. He's founder of Adventure Cycling and one of the early riders on Tosser. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, happy to be here.
Now, Greg, you came to town for this. It's this weekend.
That's right.
So where did you come from, and do you come every year?
Well, I live in Missoula, Montana now, and I used to come almost all the time, but in recent years it's just been more difficult to come east. So I actually haven't ridden a full Tosser in better than 10 years.
Charlie, you joined Tosser 3 years after it started in 1962.
Right. Danny Burton, Greg's former partner in setting up Adventure Cycling, talked me into riding it. And so we went down the road, and I busted up three fingers that year and got laid up. So
that was your first time when you busted those three fingers. I wasn't sure about that. How much did it take to get you to go on the trip? Because this was just a few people at that point.
Yeah, we were, the year I rode, I think we were 46 of us. And then the next year was about 112. And then it kept growing bigger each year.
And what kept you with it?
Well, I don't know. I used to be a boater before I got into cycling. And then I got hooked on cycling, and so really enjoyed it. And the people that rode seemed to really enjoy it. So, and we've had people that come back for now for 25 to 30 years. Of the tour.
I have someone close to me who's ridden it several times, and my recollection is the weather always stinks.
Oh, yeah. We have unpredictable weather, and then, of course, this year is even more rain than we've ever had on Tosser.
Greg, you started out as a child, right? I guess we lost Greg. Okay.
I don't know how old he was when he first started.
Greg, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. When did you start?
Well, it was the first year when my father and I rode, and I was 16 years old.
Okay. What do you remember of it, and why in the world would people continue to do this for 50 years?
Well, the year we went, we didn't know anybody who would consider going with us. the first tour was in July, so it was very hot and humid, and we had a lot of fog. I think the first 25 miles of each day. And the reason we went is my father had been a bicyclist in the 1930s, and I used to be very intrigued with his stories about the bicycling he did. And the war interrupted his cycling. And I was born just after the war, so he wasn't bicycling at all. And when I turned 15, 16, I just got real interested in his stories, and he suggested that we do this ride. And the following year, he wasn't so interested in going again, but I was, and people started to show up, mostly young guys with 10-speed bicycles that were just coming onto the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I was meeting a few, and the second year I got three guys to go with me. And then every subsequent year, more and more people seemed to want to go. And it was basically a baby boomer phenomenon. people just looking for something fresh, something new. There were the aspects of the environment and health and so on, and it just started to blossom.
We're talking about the 50th anniversary tour of the Scioto River Valley. If you have ridden the tour of the Scioto River Valley, give us a call and let us know what it was like. Tell us about the weather, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can go to the website and post there as well at wosu.org/allsides. So let's get back to the weather, because one way to maybe solve the problem would be to change the date from Mother's Day weekend to something a little later in the season, perhaps, Charlie.
There's a reason we have it on Mother's Day, and that's because when people book motel space in Portsmouth, there's only so many motels, and they never know the next tour date unless we have it Mother's Day weekend. Then there's no question. And one of the hotels goofed up down there about 2 years ago or 3 years ago and set up the wrong date, and then they found out and had to change it. Because it's Mother's Day when you leave Tasserv the first year to go back the next year, you'll know it's going to be Mother's Day.
And anyone ever criticize you for that?
Oh, mother occasionally, although the mothers sometimes like it because they have a nice rest at home.
Exactly. So, Charlie, why do you think the ride has endured over 50 years? What is it about people that like to go back to the same ride year after year? It has changed a little bit, but it's been the same thing for a long time.
Yeah, we've changed the route since the original route.
Right.
We don't go down 104 to Circleville anymore. We avoided Route 104 because of the truck traffic there. But most of the people that come back, it's almost like a reunion for them. They see their old friends that they saw last year, and they always look forward to it.
Greg?
Yeah, and it's also a way to kind of measure what kind of shape you're in, because most of the people that ride the tour will do other bicycling activities during the course of the year. And having it early in the year, it's something to shoot for. And you know that if you can do the 200 miles in May, that you're good for the season.
Just touring, bike touring in general has grown in popularity since 50 years ago. You started adventure cycling. How did that come about, Greg?
There were actually four of us that are the co-founders.
One of the co-founders, right.
Adventure cycling. The tour had done so well, and we were all four of us were advocates for bicycle touring, wanted to see it grow. And after we'd seen how well Tazer had done, we decided that we would bicycle from Alaska to Argentina.
Of course.
And this was my wife, June, and I, and Dan and Liz Burden. And June of 1972, we set out from Alaska. And it was a journey that was take us 18,000 miles over 2.5 years. And in the course of that tour, we began to look ahead once again, and we thought we saw the bicentennial of the nation coming up, and we decided that a big bike ride across America would be just the thing. And so while we were on our way to Argentina, we began formulating this idea. And then in 1976, the bicentennial year, we had 4,000 people bicycling all or part of a trail that ran all the way across the country from Oregon to Virginia. And the summer was such a success that we decided to be more than an event and became a national touring organization. And now we have 40,000 members and a magazine, and we have about 35,000 miles of mapped route for people. So it all kind of grew out of Tazerv in a sense.
Now, Charlie, why did you want to become tour director of Tazerv? Did you imagine in 1967 that would be the huge success that it's become? I'm just wondering why you decided to be, instead of just enjoying the ride, you decided to get it organized.
Well, I enjoyed it, but it needed to be organized, and I felt we needed some sort of food stop operations, because you come into a town like Circleville or Chillicothe with several hundred people, you really have to feed them and take care of their problems and service them. So we set up food stops. And then over the years, I found out I could buy Army fuel kitchen burners they use for stoves for heating hot chocolate because we wanted to have hot chocolate in the morning.
Because it's always very
cold.
So it
kind of expanded.
Yeah.
We used to have a lot of youth at Road Tosser. Originally, the numbers of young people were so big that Worthington and Arlington High Schools planned their prom around Tosser so it wouldn't be a conflict. So, but we're hoping to get those youth back on bikes. It's just difficult with all the things that are available for youth to do nowadays. So cycling's kind of back in the back burner.
There was a peak period when there were 6,000 or 7,000 people riding it.
We had 6,300, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we had double pace lines passing double pace lines passing double pace lines getting out of Portsmouth on a two-lane state route. And somebody was going to get killed. Unfortunately, other rides started popping up, probably because of Tosser, we think. And so the numbers started declining, and that was a good omen for us. And actually, 3,000, which was what we could hit this year, 2,800, is adequate for the state routes because it's too many, and it's too dangerous when you get that many people.
Do you limit the number of people?
Well, we used to.
Okay.
We had Herman P. Finkbottom letters that we sent out. Sorry, the tour is full, but we haven't had to do that of recent. There's a lot of tours all over the country that have started up since Tosser.
And that's all good.
That helps, yes.
Yeah, I think Charlie has a good point that you know, as I mentioned, when Dad and I rode that first year and there wasn't anybody who would consider going with us, and one of the things that boosted the numbers then in the following years was people coming from Chicago and New York and people, because there wasn't anywhere else to do something like this, and they take the idea home, and many of the mass participation tours are all over the country now have their roots in Tosser. And that is one reason the numbers declined, is that people don't have to come from Iowa to do a tour like that. They can just do one like it at home.
Brian in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I heard your topic today. I actually belong to the group providing first aid for Tosser. I did it last year as one of the SAG vehicles, and this year I tried to sign up in March with my team, and all my other teammates beat me to it. So I will be at the, instead of a vehicle, be at the halfway mark down in Circleville providing first aid with a couple of partners of mine. Had a lot of fun last year. It was my first year, and wanted to come back and do it again. They put on a good event, and so really looking forward to it, and on all the riders that are there as well.
How many people volunteer, Charlie?
Oh, we probably have upwards to 300. And then we have our own first response group to take care of all the medical problems of the tour riders and call the EMTs. And so we've got probably 40 to 50 ham radio operators that sit out there on the road to make sure there's a radio operator usually about every 2 miles. So if somebody's injured, they can call in one of our first response people to assist them.
What kind of issues with injuries do you have?
Last year we had no hospital runs. We were very fortunate. And usually it's just Band-Aids and cuts and bruises and scratches. And people get too close to somebody's back wheel and boom, down they go. But we were very fortunate last year not having. We had one death resulting of Tosserve several years back, but he wasn't on our tour route. So basically we can't control where he goes. He went up Route 23 and he shouldn't have been on the state route.
Randy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you. I thought that would be really neat to share two novel memories from prior Tosser rides. As was said before, Mother's Day is day two of the ride.
Mm-hmm.
Last year when I came out of Portsmouth, Ohio, the first Hams radio volunteer had a huge billboard up against his bumper in large letters were the words, "Call Mom." And I saw people reaching for their cell phones out of the back of their cycling jerseys to call their mothers. And then when I came up into Columbus at the end of the journey, we come back up through High Street and German Village, and you could not park your bike anywhere near planks because everybody was having a beer before they finished their journey.
Why did you start going on Tosser?
I do a lot of bicycle riding, and for many years, because of grand mal seizures, I could not ride. Brain surgery cleaned me up. I'm now free to ride, so I love going down to the hills of southern Ohio.
Are you going to ride this year?
Oh, yes. I'll do it again. And my final destination when I get back to Columbus is 2 more miles to Grater's Ice Cream for a giant sundae.
Okay. Thank you, Randy, for your call.
Thank you. Take care.
At least he's not going to Planks this year, huh? That's our problem with luggage. People stop at the bar and they don't get their luggage in time.
Jeff in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann, Charlie, this is, and Greg, this is Jeff Stevens. Hey, I had the opportunity.
From Consider Biking.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to ride with Mayor Coleman last year, which was a real hoot. And I know that other celebrities, like I believe a governor has ridden Towser. I'm just wondering what other fun celebrities or, you know, bike racers or, you know, memorable people have ridden Towser. Love a little history there.
Well, Greg Lashutka rode for many years, and Governor Celeste rode 3 years, I think, or four. But those are the main ones I know of.
Yeah, and there's some people from the bicycling world, like Lon Haldeman.
Oh, yes.
Who for a while had the cross-country record. He was a rider several years.
That's right.
And there's some bike racers, too, that like a fellow named Alan Kingsbury, who started Towser just as a 12-year-old and then later rose to national prominence as a bike racer.
Are you riding it this year, Jeff?
I think parts and pieces. I'll get down there for the photo at least.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Jeff.
Okay, thank you,
care.
Guys.
Charlie, this is your last year.
Yep.
As tour director.
After 44 years, I finally kind of throw it in the towel.
Well, what do you think, what made you want to devote so much of your life to this?
Well, the most satisfying thing to me are the comments you get from riders who participated in the tour after the tour's over. I get really nice emails and letter feedbacks, and it's kind of nice to feel you've made somebody's weekend.
What is your proudest, I guess, what about it are you proudest of? What about Tasso?
Just the fact it's lasted so long and we've got so many followers.
Greg, what do you think is the most important impact on Tasso, from Tasso?
Well, I think that it was that during that period when bicycling was just emerging as an adult activity, and it was so important in demonstrating to people how wonderful a bicycle tour could be, and the fact that you could, almost everybody can get on a bicycle and ride 100 miles. And it was just an example, and it just this idea really spread across the country.
Well, I wish the weather reports are all wrong, totally wrong, and I wish you warm weather and sunny skies and hopefully some tailwinds.
Both days.
Both days, and I want to thank you for joining us, Greg Seipel, co-founder of Adventure Cycling. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And also, Charlie Pace, congratulations on 44 years with the tour of the Scioto River Valley.
Well, thank you.
And thanks for joining us, and thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.